Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing Boko Haram's resurgence and Islamist attacks in Nigeria and the Lake Chad Basin region. I'm joined by a very special guest and a friend, Dr. Vincent Fulcher. Dr. Fulcher is a senior research fellow at the National Center for Scientific Research in France. He's also researcher at the Bordeaux Institute of Political Studies, Sciences Po. He holds a PhD in political studies from the School of Oriental and African Studies here in London. Vincent, it's a pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Very happy to be with you, Michael.
Brilliant. So you and I have been in this, I don't want to call it business, or this field of in the last, I'll say, from 2009 till now, coming to nearly 20 years of Boko Haram's escalation. And we've seen throughout this phase, we've seen times when Boko Haram has gone quiet and times when it's resurgent being in the news. So it looks like at one point, a couple of years ago, we thought Boko Haram was a thing of the past, was history. But now we're seeing a recent escalation in the conflict. What is behind this recent escalation and resurgence?
Well, I think, first of all, one should never overinterpret the ebbs and flows in an insurgency. You know, insurgent forces, they're always about timing. Sometimes they attack, and then sometimes they wait, they reorganize, because they are on the weaker side on the conflict and facing state armies. They are able to tune off and then go back at it. And there is a tendency in this crisis, I guess, because people are tired and would very much like to end. And of course, governments are always very keen to announce that, you know, it's over. There was this famous phrase, the last kicks of a dying horse. Well, it's a horse that's been dying for a decade, and I'm afraid that it's going to die for still quite a bit. So I don't think we should, you know, pay too much attention to the curve of incidents. I think what one should look like is the structure. You know, how is it that the governance of the jihadi groups operates? Are they well resourced? Are they able to recruit? And if they are, even if they're not attacking, that means they will still be doing it at some point or at some point or another.
That is so true, and we've seen that over the course of his lifespan. But one of the things we've seen as well, and you've written about this recently, we've looked at how not just the ebb and flow, we've looked about the changes in the structure. We've seen factions and different talk about those factions, because sometimes we tend to put this in the umbrella body and say Boko Haram, and people just say Boko Haram, but they're different. So let's unpack what Boko Haram is and the different factions that constitute this organization.
So that takes me back actually to 2017, my very first time in Maiduguri, and I was interviewing those herders, and were talking about this very different Boko Haram that they were now meeting in the bush. And they were saying, well, you know, those guys, they're not attacking us or killing us or stealing our cattle. I mean, they come to us. They say that they'll protect us against the plunderers. And that, you know, if we pay zakat, if we pay a small tax, then, you know, we'll be good with them. And actually, if we bring some foodstuff, they might buy it from us at a good price. And I was very surprised, actually, listening to that. You know, there was the 2016 split of ISWAP and deserted Shekau, basically, and secured the recognition of the Islamic State. And their critique was very explicit. They were saying that plundering people does no good. You need to be able to have good connections or at least a degree of acceptance with the local people, because you need to be able to trade, to buy, to sell, to tax, to recruit. If your modus operandi is just plunder, then you're not going to have all that. And so there was a very strong way in which ISWAP actually implemented those reforms. And we are still seeing this today, actually. My impression is ISWAP carries out a rationalization of jihad. Like, they are really transforming their operations. The sense that they're bureaucratizing their operations. You know, there's lots of paperwork, tax receipts, internal control. You know, they are much more controlling of their actions and the actions of their fighters than Shekau was, and that Shekau's successor, Bakura Doro, the current imam of Jamaat al-Sunnah al-Hida wal Jihad, they are much more controlling, and that gives them a much more efficient way of mobilizing resources and using resources.
Mm. Very interesting. So you mentioned ISWAP and you mentioned Bakura, which is a follow-up from Shekau. And there you mentioned. So, but one thing you've also mentioned is the sort of distinction between ISWAP. So ISWAP is the Islamistic West African province, which is a big faction that emerged from Boko Haram in 2016. But you mentioned Bakura, but also from your work, Bakura is not just the only faction that has splitted from the former parent body of Jazz. So how do all these other bodies fit into the picture?
So there is a very early split, actually, which already has a lot to do, in fact, with a criticism of Shekau's brutal way. It's the Ansaru split that dates back to the sort of late 2011, early 2012. And already there, there was a criticism of Shekau's ways. And Ansaru, which is actually, which grouped the people who were mostly based in towns elsewhere in the north than the northeast, which was really Shekau's place. And this group has not had a lot of success, largely because they had not accumulated the social capital that Mohamed Yusuf and Abu Bakr Shekau had gathered in the northeast. So there's a very strong, actually very strong social movement. Before the insurgency of 2009, there was a massive social movement in the northeast built by those people, and which is still in a way anchoring jihad in that area. So the Ansaru split has not been very successful, even though now it seems that it's kind of being recast thanks to the assistance of Jenim, the Al-Qaeda affiliate of the Sahel. Mm-hmm. When Shekau died in 2021, as a result of the invasion of his aunt in central Borno in the forest of the Sambisa, mm-hmm, by ISWAP, then the different subgroups of Jazz were kind of wondering, you know, which direction would they go, and so we have at least four different groups that we must mention. First, there was the group of Bakura Doro on the northern part of Lake Chad, and Bakura actually proclaimed himself the Imam of Jazz by actually killing his predecessor, the first successor of Shekau, another Bakura Sa'alaba, and Bakura basically killed him and took over. And so the other groups that were connected to Jazz were hesitant initially. There was the group in the Mandara Mountains of Ali Ngulde. There was a group of which is called Dar al-Ghazouah, so around Bama, the town of Bama. And then there was also the group of Sadiku, a small group that Shekau had sent out in the northwest in Niger State to sort of develop jihad there. And those three groups were, you know, wondering about whether Bakura was an acceptable leader, partly because they were, you know, they were questioning his religious credentials, and you know, saying, well, you know, this guy is not a scholar, so how could he be the imam? But my impression is actually, by and large, those three groups have since largely accepted Bakura as their leader, partly because Bakura has a very interesting things in this context. He has access to lots of weapons. Because of the regional trafficking, which arrives in the northern part of Lake Chad, and also because of the weaponry is taken from ISWAP in attacks against ISWAP. So I think by now, actually, Bakura's control is much firmer than it used to be.
And then again, I will come up to, so early 2020, by 2021, when Shekau died, we then see, whereas when you mentioned Asaru in 2011, 2012, the split, we didn't see so much in fighting. We could say ideological split, but we also saw some form of cooperation. And I know we've written about this, and Jacob Zen has written about this kind of stuff. But interesting thing about the split of ISWAP, and especially from 2021 when Shekau was killed, was we started seeing heavy infighting that it looks like the military or the Nigerian government has benefited from. And at one point, it looks like ISWAP, like you rightly said, more organized, more bureaucratic, and was able to have an upper hand. But it seems that is changing now with recent escalations. What is this? Describe this up and down fight where the Bakura group or Boko Haram group is having some upper hand, whereas in the past ISWAP was happening. What is happening to these dynamics in power and shifting in advantage?
It's a very good question. My impression is, so initially the JAS groups were, you know, taken by surprise. They were really amazed that Shekau could lose like this. You know, Shekau used to be the big name, and ISWAP used to be the challenger. So how come the challenger faction had been able to overtake Shekau like this? And I think there was quite a bit of shock initially. Very soon after Shekau's death, Bakura fighters did try to attack ISWAP, and it didn't go too well. My impression is, I think people were a bit lost. And I think somehow Bakura has been able to reorganize. And I think a key factor in his reorganization is a reliance on his control of the lake, the deeper waters of the lake, the islands, and the fact that he has influence, allies within the Buduma community. I think it's very important not to think of those movements as you know, ethnically based. Both JAS and ISWAP are a mix. You know, Kanuri, Hausa, Glavda, Guduf, Babur. I mean, there's a bit of everyone in there. There is certainly a strong historical Kanuri component because the movement was born in Maiduguri, which is a very Kanuri city, and so on. But it really is very much like the 19th century jihad. It's an aggregator, you know. It groups people and it fuses people, including in new identities. It's not like jihad was born in Mali. Very much, you know, small networks in trading networks. Usually with an ethnic identification. Boko Haram was born in the cities, in the trading cities of Borno and the northeast, and just like those trading cities, it was always an ethnic mix, and it was always a Hausa speaking insurgency. If you look at the sort of internal conversation, a lot of it happens in Hausa. You know, some in Kanuri, yes, and Mohamed Yusuf and Shekau were, you know, appreciated as Kanuri speakers, right? But a lot of the conversation actually happens in Hausa. I think it's quite telling. So, you know, this caveat is very important. This is not an ethnic stuff at all. But there is something, like for some of the Buduma, in a way, Boko Haram offers a sort of revenge against the dominance of the sort of large Hausa traders and entrepreneurs over the lake. A number of Bakura, of Buduma fighters have been able to use affiliation to jihad as a way to recoup their control over the lake, over the resources of the lake, and Bakura has been very good at garnering this support. He's not a Buduma himself, But he has very strong Buduma connection, so much so actually that he's often nicknamed as Bakora Buduma, but he's not a Buduma himself. And he does speak some Buduma, but the thing is, I think it's partly because of his very Shekau-like style, you know, plunder, raiding, a very aggressive attitude towards neighbors, the outsiders, you know, from on the shores of the lake. I think it's sort of it's a nice fit for a number of Buduma fighters. So what we've seen actually is some Buduma fighters who were with ISWAP who eventually chose to side with Bakora, and that has given Bakora a lot of punch. And the way in which defectors from both factions talk about this is, you know, Bakora is very good on the waters, but on the shores, he's not up, you know, he's not up for ISWAP. And we've seen actually ISWAP lose a lot of the islands in the high waters that it used to control.
One of the two questions that are coming up. Like I mentioned two chapters in our upcoming book. So one of it talks about the Lake Chad. You mentioned Lake Chad and talk about the climate resource and the resource bottleneck and there are the resources and all of that. And you've mentioned how control of this lake seems to be vital to the fight. So I want to talk about that in a minute, but the question that I actually want to come up from there, two questions. So I'll ask those questions and allow you to talk. So one of it is, so we try to distinguish ISWAP from Boko Haram, from Jazz, and not this faction, because we say, like Riley said, ISWAP seems to want to disassociate itself from the plundering, from the obsessive killing, of Shekau and Shekau's brazen, and you know, just Shekau's kind of distinct side. They wanted to be separate from it, and ISWAP seems to be more structured, more bureaucratic, tax and all of that. But it looks like Jazz as well, from what you said, it looks like Bakura and all of that are trying now to be organized in that way, to be able to stake territory and administer. What has caused this shift, and how does the lake, how is the control of this different lake important to all of that?
Yeah, I mean, the lake is very important because it's a fabulous trove of natural resources, you know, very good, very fertile land, water, incredible fisheries. Actually, Lake Chad has long attracted migrants from not just from Nigeria, but from distant parts of West Africa. You know, people have come from Mali actually to fish in the lake, and herders as well. You know, they will bring their cattle during the dry season to access the pastures. And when you speak with farmers who operate in the lake, they will say that you can get two or sometimes three crops a year. You know, this is a fabulously productive agricultural area. In a way, because Nigeria has all this wealth of oil, people tend to not to, you know, look too much into other natural resources. And I think this one has been overlooked. But it's long been a very, very, you know, a prized piece of natural resources. And so, Jazz in the days of Shekau started really as a movement. So it kind of improvised its economic base, you know. Mm-hmm. So first of all, what they did is basically they when they were still an urban terrorist organization, they racketeered wealthy people, traders, politicians. They would say, well, you know, you have to give us $1 million, you know, now, otherwise we'll send our killers. But then when they were pushed out of the towns, then they had to improvise. And in a way, they kept with the same logic of seizure, you know, seizure by force and threat. And they started plundering, first of all, roadblocks, you know, highway robberies, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, they began preying on the resources, agricultural resources, stealing cattle. The herds of the Shuwa Arabs, of the Fulani, were very seriously attacked in, you know, 2013, 2014. The damage was absolutely massive. Mm-hmm. But ISWAP realized that, okay, maybe it's better to structure this and to stop plundering and then to actually use a moderate taxation to fund all movements durably. And my impression is actually the Bakura faction has learned over time from this. Mm-hmm. And I guess the fact that they are sitting on the lake, you control access to the fish trade, which is, you know, particularly valuable trade, and and they've understood that, okay, then maybe we can stabilize. And I think they now are really in a competition with ISWAP on discount, and actually there is a sort of competition over tax levels. You know, the taxation rates of both organizations will tend to follow each other, right? They understand that there's a you know, commercial problem there to address. And so I think, yes, they have stabilized, especially on the Niger side of things, the Republic of Niger. They've tried to stabilize things with farmers and herders and fishermen. And it's one of the things, actually, and that has worked, that has allowed them to buy weapons, to import weapons, probably from Chad or Libya. And I think they understand that this is very profitable. Interestingly, when you speak with herders or fishermen who operate in those areas, and some of them actually operate in both, they can go fish sometimes in ISWAP territory and then go into Bakura territory as well. They will say, yeah, you know, now we can go in both areas. But ISWAP is nicer. Like, you know, the fighters, they are well behaved. They're not too rough, you know, they come take the taxes and they're polite. Whereas the Bakura people, you never quite know. Like you feel they really are not happy about us, in the sense that, you know, probably the sort of heritage of Shekau's vision of everyone outside my group is just kufar, you know, they're just infidels and you should not be nice to them. Maybe that heritage is still there.
Speaking of the people, another chapter that is coming up from our book is we're talking about civilian casualties. And we look at the pre 2015, 2016 time, there was heavy civilian casualties. Shekau was indiscriminate. Like you rightly said, Shekau didn't care about whether you're Muslim, as long as you know within. Shekau was attacking everybody, and there was heavy civilian casualty. But one thing we noticed there's a deep in civilian casualty. But again, whether it's ISWAP now, whether it's this, we're beginning to see some civilian casualties now. So what would you say, and from your experience of these farmers and fishers that are straddling these different territories, do you think they're being caught in the crossfire of both Shekau and stuff? And then looking at tying that into IDP camps and people that are asked to return and then being killed and all of that. So what is leading to these heightened civilian casualties in the fight, in this recent resurgence?
So the way in which violence towards civilians evolves, I think, is we've always seen actually some very harsh violence by certain ISWAP units against civilians. But those were always cases in which ISWAP had something to reproach to the civilians. You know, those were civilians who were trying to evade taxation, who were not following orders, or who were suspected of being close to the state. So those were very targeted instances. And again, I insist, when you speak with civilians in most of those areas, they will say that they know that they're safe when ISWAP is around. Like, ISWAP is not going to be a bother. Then if you don't behave, if you, for instance, take part to the import of tramol, for instance, which is ISWAP doesn't like at all, then you're going to get into trouble, and you can actually see, you know, very significant violence in those cases. And I guess perhaps partly because ISWAP has been a bit nervous because of Bakura's pushback. I think this has made them particularly suspicious of civilians, you know, acting as spies or, you know, cooperating with Bakura in a way or another. And I think this may explain some of the extreme violence, you know, rare cases of extreme violence that ISWAP visits upon civilians. And then you also still have the preying, you know, the plunder of the Bakura people. And we're seeing this, you know, it's very small incidents, a bunch of fighters. You see that in Cameroon, for instance. You see that in northern Borno as well, where some Bakura fighters infiltrate themselves. But actually, my impression is now is it's less a question of you know, rage killing, as it were. I think it's more a question of finding targets to ransom. And I think that's one of the big things that we've seen developing, especially in northern Borno. Is Bakura groups ransoming civilians to fund the movement. And actually operating in these swap control areas as well to do this kidnapping and ransoming.
Let's go to the strategies, all the strategies. So when iSwap split from Boko Haram, so one of the ways it tends to distinguish itself was re-strategizing and forming a specific target that we saw within 2010, before Shekau, when between 2010 and 2012, these were the kind of things we saw. It was targeted, you know, whether it's government, whether it's the military, whether it's before it went just all ballistic. So, but within when this came up, we saw that similar stuff. The Nigerian military suffered heavy casualties within maybe 2016 and 18, 19, before Buhari came and they restructured. But now again, I think we're beginning to see that the Nigerian military recently, Brigadier General was killed. I don't know if it's ISWAP or whatever. We need to see that the Nigerian military is you know, suffering some casualty of difficulty. What do you think is this within the framework of a new strategy coming to re-strategize and yeah?
Yeah, I think, I mean, ISWAP has adapted a lot and there are reasons why ISWAP is particularly adaptive. I think, first of all, ISWAP is born from criticism, you know, from self-reflection and criticism. It's born from criticizing Shekau's ways. And so those guys have long been talking about how they should do and how they could do better, you know, more efficient jihad. I think another reason for why they're being innovative is they are really connected to the Islamic State. There are more and more signs than ever that some white Arab fighters are present there, visiting or actually resettling. And those guys bring a wealth of experience from other jihad elsewhere, and they can help also ISWAP adapt. And so that means ISWAP has been, over the years, changing tactics very substantially. You know, the change in tactics from the time of Shekau was already immense. They created actually a much smaller force of professional fighters who would be, you know, full-time fighters. Not the kind of mumble jumbo of people with guns, you know, from kids from 8 to 55. Like ISWAP has structured units with a set number, with, you know, proper ranking and everything. Uniforms, actually, the wearing of uniforms is also something related to ISWAP. And so eventually the state actually adapted to that. Nigerian authorities have strongly reinforced the air force and both you know, attack helicopter gunships, ground air-to-ground airplanes like Tucano, and also drones, which are quite efficient when you're grouping large columns of vehicle. You know, that's very efficient if you can have air attacks like this. But then that means, so ISWAP was able to score very big hits in from 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019. And then from 2020, the returns of those operations diminished. You know, they because of this Air Force reinforcement, ISWAP was less able to get away with those attacks. What we've seen actually from this year, especially maybe May, June, and we've seen interesting innovations. We've seen the use of weaponized drones carrying explosives. We've seen also night attacks, sometimes including night vision equipment, night vision goggles. So, you know, it's a way to adapt to the way in which Nigeria had adapted to ISWAP. And I think, you know, this is essentially the logic of those kind of wars. The attacker adapts and then the defender adapts and so on. And you move on like this. We're seeing this actually in Ukraine as well. It's the same dynamics. And I think that ISWAP is very well placed precisely because it has resources and knowledge to innovate, because of the money it has and also because of the advice it gets from the Islamic State.
Yeah, so you mentioned Tutsis. Let's tackle one. So we've seen in the breakdown of early on in Boko Haram, the toppling and eventual killing of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya has been cited in Boko Haram literature as one that had some adverse impact in the escalation of Boko Haram in terms of weapon flow. Now again, we're seeing some dynamics within the region with the coup in Niger and the Islamic State. And so how is that impacting on this resurgence? Does it have any impact in a significant way?
Maybe actually just taking the time, because it's an interesting question, the question of the impact of Libya on the, on events in the Lake Chad Basin. There's a study from a while back from, I think it was Small Arms Survey, that examined the weapons captured by the Nigerian forces, comparing those captured on the Mali border and those captured in Diffa region. And there was very clear, very strong evidence that some of the weapons captured on the Malian front were coming from Libya. Like it was, it could be demonstrated. The effect, there was some effect also in the Lake Chad Basin, but the effect was actually much weaker. And I think there's a misconception here. When you talk to former fighters, they will say that a lot of the weapons, actually, the initial weapons, they were bought in Chad, because Chad has a long history of, you know, civil wars and rebel movements. So there's plenty of weaponry around, and it's a very good place to buy weapons, Chad. Or it was a very good place to buy weapons in those days. And then eventually the jihadists in the Lake Chad Basin, they armed themselves, taking from the local police and military. One of the things that they were doing during the 2010, 2011, 2012 urban terror campaign, they were attacking policemen, not just because they wanted to kill policemen, but also to rob their weapons because they needed the weapons. So, you know, I think a lot of the weaponry actually was obtained locally. Though I do hear that there were some Libyan connections, especially in terms of ammunition, which is actually a real issue. It's difficult to get good ammunition, and it can be quite expensive. So some of it came from there. And then I took a tangent, and I don't remember your question. So please,
it's just like to look at if the recent crisis in that region, like with the coup, Niger,
Yeah, I mean, it has impact in different ways, I suppose, in ways that we are not perceiving yet, actually, also. But what we can say is, for instance, that the difficult relationship between Niger and Nigeria is making the common struggle in you know, along the Komadugu River. So that's the river that separates Niger from Nigeria in the northern Mono. The coordination is much weaker than what it used to be. You know, remember there was a moment when Nigerian troops actually entered into Nigerian territory at the invitation of the federal government to help in the fight against Boko Haram. That was a very substantial degree of collaboration. We're still seeing, it seems, some collaboration sort of locally organized by commanders. But yeah, that certainly is an issue. That's a big problem. Another issue is also probably the fact that this facilitates these cross-border movements of goods, weapons, you know, the fact that the regional cooperation is not as good. It's great for the logistics of these jihadi movements. They are more likely to be able to move goods and weapons around. One big question I have, I think we should really be attentive to that, is the effect of the massive war currently going on in Sudan, which is, you know, with a lot of foreign powers bringing in weaponry. I mean, this is a very, you know, a mix of a very ancient and a very modern war. And I'm really worried about the sort of potential effects of that situation as well.
It's what's worrying, because we've just done an episode on that, to be honest, and we look at how that conflict, it's a lot ethnic based in it, the different, if you differentiate that from the kind of one in Boko Haram where you have different, it's quite ethnic based, and also looking at this link to Chad. Look at some of those ethnic group in Sudan have some ethnic affinity to Chad, and how that connection can happen. But I agree with you on, okay, go on.
I can just barge in on this. My concern is perhaps less these sort of ethnic connections, because I don't know. I'm not sure how that would actually translate in the Lake Chad Basin context. My concern is more again the degree of innovation that you can get from having a very, you know, technologically more advanced war next door. There was someone I interviewed actually after JAS seized a number of armored vehicles in 2014. They had a problem because they had no one to pilot those engines. You know, you need trained pilots to use armored vehicles. Mm. And what they did is actually they sent someone to the Central African Republic to see whether they could recruit or hire temporarily some Central African soldiers who had been trained in driving heavy vehicles. Mm. And actually, they did try to organize this. In the end, they did not need to do all the way, but they tried that. And I'm very much worried about, you know, those kind of potential effects. Some experts actually, you know, bringing in extra knowledge
In my research, I also heard that early on, where you mentioned the Kanama and all of that. I was hearing that early on when Boko Haram was going, they were going with mechanics, they were going with people that have such kind of artisan skills. To operate, and then there's been also again there's a lot of focus on external expertise, like you've mentioned, but the people have not talked about local capacity building in terms of weaponry, in terms of building local capacity towards this stuff. I know again during those early years, the German government or the German military uncovered a lot of cells or military warehouse where Boko Haram was kind of like developing weapons and stuff like that. But I'd also agree with you on the locus, and I've written about this in 2014. I've listened that many of the weapons, and I called for like it should be more defending the arsenals, because they were just getting those arsenals freely, like Giwa barracks, all of this. They were just getting those kind of like arsenals. But the question is, in 2015-16, the Nigerian government started with this operation Safe Corridor and all of these kind of like operations, and we've seen thousands of repentant Boko Haram, but then we're seeing these escalations now, and then this the society of being against the reintegration. Do you think the reintegration of this have been successful, or do you think there's been some, what's that word now, it's just gone off my head now, where people go back, you're just gonna go back to returns, but it's called something, you know, it's just gone off my head. But do you think that's happening? And if that's happening, is that significant?
Yeah, so in the early days of defection programs, I don't think there were lots of returns actually. Some women might return. But for the men, it would have been very difficult because the groups would be very suspicious of people returning, and they would actually fear those who were spies. Mm. But now I think things have changed a bit. Defections have been massive, you know, especially after the death of Shekau, probably several thousand fighters in all from both factions have surrendered. And if you add, you know, families and civilians who are living in jihadi-controlled areas, it's way more. But, you know, I think you can confidently say that at least several thousand of fighters have defected. The problem is that the defection programs are not as intensive now as they used to be in the time of Safe Corridor, when Safe Corridor was the only time in game in town. Safe Corridor, defectors would be taken to a facility, would be there for several months. It would be a fairly substantial program controlled by the military in a situation which was in a way quite similar to a prison, right? The Borno model, which Governor Zulum had to improvise as a result of the massive defections resulting from Shekau's death, is much lighter. The demands are much less significant. The fighters stay with their family. Very often they stay with the commanders under which they were and whom with they defected. You know, the degree of control and support is weaker now. Actually, some of the defectors you can interview now, they don't even make it to the Borno model because the sites of the Borno model in Maiduguri are completely crowded. Now, people would sort of surrender in Monguno or Bama. The military would welcome them, interview them. They would eventually give some money if they bring a weapon. There's a buyback program. And then they would just be transferred to the IDP camp. Because the capacity is just not there to handle those guys. And so then it's for each one of these guys to decide what they want to do. You know, did they leave? Did they? And some of them left because they had, you know, they had really grown tired of all this. And I think some of the people I've interviewed, there's no way they're going back there. They're just done with that. You know, they don't want. But others, they left for more tactical reasons. You know, they had a problem, like the infighting was not good, or maybe they did some, you know, maybe they misbehaved a bit in the group and they felt it was safer to get out. So, and I think a lot of it will depend on what they find in, you know, Mongono Obama. Can they find an income generating activity? Can they meet up with their families again? How welcoming are the communities? You know, maybe people remember that they did bad things in 2010 or 2011, and then it's going to be difficult for them to stay there. So I think those factors actually are quite important in deciding what happens. I think it's very important to make room for both possibilities. You know, I really think a significant number of those who have defected are not going back. But yes, we hear more and more that some people are going back, and it's probably more of those recently defected people who haven't gone through those very resource-intensive defection programs. Interestingly, ISWAP used to be quite hostile to defectors returning. They would be sent to jail, they would be detained for several months, they would be investigated and so on. But now, from what I hear, ISWAP is much more relaxed about those defectors. I think it's partly because they've lost quite a lot of manpower to Bakura and also to the Air Force attacks as well. And they feel they need to replenish the ranks, and now they are sort of willing to relax a bit on their security checks. JAS seems to have been under Bakura quite welcoming of defectors, quite keen to accept those people.
Mm. Before we come to the last question, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the gender dynamics, and that's one of our things, the weakness in our book. We didn't really have that like a chapter focus on that. So you were talking about women are more likely to, and we've seen where with the work of Neem and Fatima Kilu dealing with former stuff, and we've seen some women that are willing, maybe wives of Boko Haram commandants or people that are willing to go back, and all of that kind of stuff, expressed that. What is the gender dynamics now compared to early on? We saw Shekau were using women. Women were played a critical, whether as suicide bombers or stuff like that. What is that? I wanted to combine that question also with you talked about Ansaru and then JNIM. I know ISWAP and Boko Haram as JAS have tried to extend to, you mentioned the Sadiku group, they've tried to extend to the Northwest unsuccessfully. What is happening there with all of these different groups, Lakuruwa group, different group coming up in Northwest? Mm-hmm. So talk about our two questions, and then I will ask you the last question.
Okay. So the question of women, I think, you know, the women that have come back from Boko Haram, very often they have not actually defected from Boko Haram. They've been picked up by the military during operations. Mm-hmm. And whereas a lot of the men would be jailed or actually sometimes executed, the women would be brought back to the IDP camps. But a single woman without a husband, with children in an IDP camp in Maiduguri, it's not an enviable situation. You know, it's difficult. It's a very difficult environment. And some of those women, especially those who are married to, you know, established or senior jihadists, they had a fairly good life in the Sambisa forest or in Lake Chad. You know, easy access to food, no requirement to work outside the house, you know, because there is this seclusion rule. They have to stay in house. So for a number of women, ending up in those IDP camps in Maiduguri or Monguno didn't feel like a liberation at all. And a number of them actually have gone back, and it makes sense because they are less well equipped than men actually to reintegrate in the urban economy. Men, the ones I'm speaking with, the defectors I talk to, they find employment in the, you know, informal economy as you know, vendors or porters or those kind of functions. They can squeeze in somehow. For women, it's very difficult. So that explains it. And so you still have on both sides. You have families. You have women. You have children being born, being raised there. You have you know, in some areas, you have children, you know, now 10 or 12 year old, who were born under jihadi control and who've been there and who've been schooled in the Quranic schools that the jihadi organization maintain. So that's the thing, gender-wise. The question of expansion, that is a very tricky one. I have a piece actually that I've worked on with James Barnett and Dr. Rufai on the Sadiku group. So it's a jazz group that operates in the Northwest. Mm. And interestingly, it's perhaps so far the most successful jihadist groups to have grown new roots in a very different context. Sadiku himself is a man from Borno, he's a Babur from southern Borno. And he took a small group west, and somehow he was able to build a complex and a bit unstable relationship both with Ogwari autochthonous communities, actually interestingly Christian communities of rural dwellers, but also cut deals with bandits in a creative way, protecting the Gwari and associating himself for operation with the bandits, providing them some services as well, maintaining the weapons, for instance. They were the ones together who carried out the Kaduna train attack. Mm-hmm. And that allowed Sadiku to rake in a substantial amount of money, with which he's been able to irrigate his networks and sort of maintain this relationship, this set of relationship. The thing is, it's unstable. And finally, Sadiku and Dogo Gide, so the sort of top bandit leader he was working with, they ran out of in their collaboration. They ended up fighting each other. And my understanding is that Sadiku is now moving away from Niger State, going maybe up in the directions of like Zamfara, Sokoto, trying to relate to other groups. And I think that's the big question. You know, who? It really is it is Mercato time, right? You've got bandits, you've got Jenim, the Malian jihadi organization, which is right next door, doing stuff in Benin as well. You've got these Lakurawa militia, which are actually very probably Sahelian jihadists who've sort of carved a space for themselves in northern Nigeria. Mm-hmm. You've got JAS, which has an interest. You've got ISWAP, which is also certainly building up network and training people. Mm-hmm. So I really think it's a very important moment now. And James Barnett has made this argument that banditry and jihadism are difficult to join, and in a way the trajectory of Sadiku is a witness to that. But I think now with the some nearby jihadist polarities having so much resources, so much capacity, I think maybe they'll be able to grow roots, solid roots in the Northwest. And for me, that is a very, very worrisome trend.
Yeah. Yeah, James and Dr. Rufai is contributing to the chapter as well. They made their argument. You see, he and I has a bit of our own differences in terms of the track, in terms of which I think. But we will see. So in that light, let's conclude like this. How do you project, in the light of all of these different dynamics and separate, sometimes difficult to separate? You see the banditry, the jihadis from the Sahelian, for JNIM, from all of this. What is the future of Nigeria in terms of jihadist or Islamist tragedy? How do you see this happening in the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? And again, you mentioned something very, very key. I know there's another person, what's his name now, that's writing on the chart, soldiers. And we're looking at children that are being born into, like you said, they are 12 years old. All they've known is this. What in the light of all of this, what do you see next 10, 5, 10, 20 years in that region and for Nigeria?
Yeah, I have to say I'm very concerned. Fundamentally, the thing is, those jihadi groups, and including some of the bandit groups as well, they are cost-effective systems for rural governance. They're able, and it's especially true of ISWAP, because they are able to provide some services. They can provide some education, some health, to the population, some services. They can maintain law and order on a fairly substantial scale. And the problem is that it's difficult for the state, or the state has not been able so far to identify ways to durably control rural areas where the jihadists and to an extent also the bandits have settled. So the military, they are able to go anywhere they want. You know, if they prepare a column of armed vehicle and bring two gunships and so on, probably they can go anywhere they want. The problem is they don't have the staying power. They're not going to stay there. They're going to go back after a week. And then the jihadists just need to, just wait for them to go, and then they come back in, and they are the ones in charge. And the rural dwellers, they know that, they understand that the real, the real power there in those rural areas are those groups. And I'm worried that it's going to be the case increasingly so, because the model is, other people have ideas. You can, I could try that in this new place. And this model, I think, has a potential to replicate. And I don't know that Nigeria has found a way to provide a credible alternative. One redeeming thing maybe is the war between the jihadi organization, because the jihadists are the best killers of jihadists. Mm. And it's true that ISWAP and JAS have killed one another with a lot of success recently. And that is certainly a way to it's a serious drain on them. Also, it's a moral drain, because a lot of the people who defect, they defect because they are frustrated with this mutual, interfactional fighting. They feel like, why are we fighting each other? It makes no sense whatsoever. So, a number of people seem to express frustration, and that's a cause for exit as well. But yeah, I think it's something that we're going to have to talk about for quite some time, Michael.
It's quite worrying. And listen, I'm going to leave it here, but maybe this is going to be, we're going to talk about this informally. I've just seen a retired Nigerian general saying they trying to take credit for the killing of Shekau. I like what you said, the jihadists are the best killers of jihad. Trying to take killing in terms of maybe they infiltrated and created those kind of dynamics that there. But maybe we talk about this informally. We're kind of running out of time. But yeah, it's worth the wait. I'm glad you made it one piece and back from your research in this region. And yes, I know you and I had some conversation in Prague in June, where we met in June. So I'll follow you up on that, on WhatsApp, and see. So, but I'm grateful. Thank you for honoring my invitation, and yes, wish you Merry Christmas, and wish you a prosperous New Year.
All the same, Michael, and thanks for the good work you're doing.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode with my great friend and great learned friend, Dr. Vincent Foucher, looking at the recent escalation in and all the dynamics of insurgencies and Boko Haram Islamist attacks in Nigeria and Niger. As usual, join me to thank him, and stay tuned for our next episode. Next week.